Chapter 21.
"One more time, Mr. O'Donnell,"
said the police officer, after they'd brought us all in, which had taken a while, because there'd been one of her and seven of us, of whom three were out in the garden, either being sad or examining insects.
"How did you and your friends come to be in Mr. and Mrs. Plastow's house?"
I told her again. I was sure that everybody else had told her as well, and I was sure our stories would be relatively consistent, but I also didn't quite trust my colleagues to be able to talk to the police without going off on long tangents about mosquitoes, their social media followers, or in several cases, what an absolute prick I was.
"So then you..."
She looked down.
"Had a cup of tea and argued with your co-workers about why you weren't inviting them to your wedding?"
I nodded. "Yes."
"Why aren't you inviting them to your wedding?"
"Is that part of the investigation?" I asked. The police officer shrugged.
"No, but they seem like nice people. One of them invited you to his wedding."
"Did you invite the entire police station to your wedding?"
"Of course."
They probably did things differently in the countryside. "Look, it's nice to get to know you and everything, but is it possible that we could maybe go now? It's been several hours and we have to be up early in the morning."
"I'd love to,"
said the police officer, with a slightly apologetic tone to her voice.
"But the problem is that not only did you break into somebody's house..."
"We didn't break in. There was a key under the mat."
"Still counts as breaking in. But then you also said that you were in the area because you were guests at one of the most exclusive society events the Northwest has seen in years, and that means your whole case has been kicked up the chain."
That didn't sound good. "Kicked up the chain?" She made an afraid-so face.
"The Twaddle Fortescue Lettuce wedding is a big deal. Security alone is dragging in Coombe Valley Police, Merseyside Police, and the Northwest Motorway Police. It's a big job."
"Which means..."
"Which means we need to make sure you and your friends aren't planning something disruptive."
"Disruptive?"
"People do all kinds of funny things at society weddings."
I let my head fall forward onto the desk. "Can you not just call Alex or Miffy? They'll tell you who we are." "Probably. Although Alex was never completely reliable when it came to remembering little things like who people were, what day it was, or what was going on."
"Sorry," she said. "Out of my hands."
I went back to... It wasn't a cell, exactly, because we weren't strictly under arrest. It was more a kind of waiting room. There, Oliver was busy having an in-depth conversation with somebody who looked like they were important, and since he was an actual proper lawyer, I figured he knew what he was doing. So I went and sat with the rest of the party. More specifically, I went and sat with Barbara Clench. "Hi," I said. She looked at me.
"Hello?"
I... That was as far as I got.
"You don't have to like me, Luke," she said.
I wasn't sure how to respond to that. My initial instinct was, good, because I don't. But that sounded dickish even to me. "It's not..." I tried, but that seemed insincere. "I mean, I don't not... You didn't invite me to your wedding." Barbara Clench gave me a look.
"I was married when we met."
"Okay, but you wouldn't have invited me." For a moment, she didn't reply. Then she laughed. She had quite a nice laugh, just cold enough to sound like she meant it.
"You're right. I wouldn't."
She looked around the room, then leaned in conspiratorially.
"I wouldn't invite any of this lot, to tell you the truth."
"I know, right?"
"And if I'm being really honest,"
she added,
"I don't think I'd want to go to your wedding either."
I breathed one of the deepest sighs of relief I had in a long time. "Oh, thank God. No offence, it's just..."
"We're not friends,"
she said, with an "at last somebody gets it" expression.
"I've got friends. I assume you've got friends. I don't see why we can't just accept
that the only thing we have in common with each other is that our inadequate paychecks are signed by the same people.
Exactly. This was actually turning into one of my better work conversations. Tell you what, how about we make a deal? I won't invite you to my wedding, and in return, you don't have to tell me anything about your life or give a single shit about mine. She held out a hand.
Done.
I shook it and did my best to smile at her.
But I don't hate you, she added.
I don't hate you either. She let go of my hand.
And let's leave it at that.
Oliver had finished talking to whoever he was talking to, but from the look of very mild frustration on his face, he'd gone into professional mode, so very mild frustration was the worst he was going to show, he hadn't got anywhere. They're being stubborn, he explained. Are we going to prison? I asked. Are we going to prison for breaking and entering? Did we break and enter on the way to a wedding? Oliver pulled up a blue plastic chair and sat down next to me. How much detail do you want on this? Damn, he was sexy when he was doing the lawyer bit. All the detail. If you insist. He smiled, and everybody else, mistaking my request for interrogation rather than flirtation, gathered round. Well, everybody except for Professor Fairclough, who was looking at a spider, even though, as I was embarrassingly proud to remember, it wasn't technically an insect. For a start, Oliver continued, somewhat surprised to suddenly have an audience, we're not going to prison for breaking and entering, because that's not a distinct crime under UK law. Burglary is a crime, and trespassing is a civil infraction. We did trespass, but it only becomes burglary if the Crown can show that we trespassed with the intent to either steal or commit grievous bodily harm or unlawful damage.
We stole tea, Barbara Clench pointed out, with the pedantic attention to detail that made her frustratingly good at her job.
Technically, we didn't, said Oliver. We drank tea that didn't belong to us. But stealing is when you dishonestly appropriate property belonging to another person, with the intent to permanently deprive them of it. Of those five elements...
How do you get five elements out of one sentence? I asked, partly because I liked playing my part in the law is cool and you're cool for knowing it game we sometimes played, and partly because I was genuinely confused.
Dishonesty, Oliver counted on his fingers, property, appropriation, belonging to another person, and intent to permanently deprive. He held up his open hand. Five.
Also, added Rhys, who was lounging across two chairs on the other side of the circle, with his head in Anna with one end's lap. It's only tea.
Oliver gave him an I-wish-it-was-that-simple kind of look. Sadly, the it's-only-tea defence isn't recognised in court. Our defence is specifically dishonesty.
Because, I tried, we thought we had the tea owner's permission to drink the tea.
Turning back to me, Oliver had been Wimbledoning between us. He gave a sort of half nod. Interestingly, consent by itself wouldn't be enough either.
What?
Anna with one end sat forward, displacing Reese's head.
I could get done for theft even if somebody has given me permission to take something.
If you came by that permission dishonestly. Oliver had gone into a law rhapsody. I liked Law Rhapsody Oliver even at 2 in the morning, at a random police station on the Welsh borders. The law specifically says appropriates, not misappropriates, and the precedent was set in 1971 when a taxi driver who took money from a tourist's wallet was found guilty of theft, because while the tourist had permitted them to take the money, the amount of money taken had been far in excess of any reasonable fare.
Anna with one end's eyes narrowed.
Why do you know so much about theft?
Feeling a sudden swell of pride, I gave Oliver a possessive hug.
Because he's a lawyer.
Barrister, Oliver gently corrected me.
I knew the difference. I just thought lawyer sounded cooler,
unless like he made flat whites for a living.
And more specifically, I'm the very unsexy kind of criminal barrister who deals with exactly this kind of law. I'm afraid I spend a lot less of my time saying, my client couldn't possibly have been guilty of this murder because the pings from this cell phone tower prove he was 10 miles away. And a lot more of it saying, my client is not technically guilty of theft because although she did leave the restaurant without paying, she formed the intent to do so only after she had already eaten the meal. And therefore, at the time the dishonest appropriation took place, the food in question was not in the restaurant's possession.
She blinked.
Do you say that a lot?
Quite a lot, yes. As I say, I'm not the glamorous sort of barrister. Young people who have skipped out on a bill are quite a large part of my client base, and it's only stealing if you decided not to pay before you ate is a well-known technicality.
Rhys gave the kind of broad grin that suggested he thought he'd had the most brilliant idea. It was a grin he got far more often than he should.
That's not a technicality, he said. That's a bloody life hack. We never have to pay to go to a restaurant again.
Bit unethical, I pointed out.
True, but think of all the free chips you could eat.
Reese's expression told me that he was thinking of exactly that. One day, I wanted somebody to look at me the way Reese looked at hypothetical free chips. Although, to be fair, Oliver sometimes did.
I mean, said Oliver, in the tones of a man who was determined to at least try to put the genie back in the bottle, you'd probably still have to go to court, and even if you won, the time, effort and lawyer's fees would cost far more than the chips in the long run.
Rhys, genie that he was, remained unperturbed.
You say that, but I can eat a hell of a lot of chips.
If you ate enough chips to cover the costs of a legal battle, Oliver observed, that might just count as evidence you formed the intent to withhold payment before consuming the meal.
It still seems like a weird loophole to me.
Anna, with one end, slipped off a trainer and wiggled her toes distractedly.
Have you ever actually got somebody off with that argument?
A couple of times.
She winced.
Isn't that a bit dodgy?
Oliver was used to this, so used to it that he'd brought it up unprompted on our first fake date. These days it made me get slightly prickly defensive on his behalf, but I knew he could field it perfectly well himself.
I appreciate it might seem that way, he said, but, well, to take a recent example, a little while ago I got somebody off for exactly this reason. I can't go into details, but the case I made was that my client and her boyfriend only formed the intent to leave without paying because they grew frustrated of a staff consistently misgendering her. She admitted it wasn't the right thing to do, but she was very upset at the time, and she found the whole process of going through a court case deeply traumatic. I don't think that being convicted of theft would have made her a better person. I don't think locking her up or fining her would have protected anybody. So, no, I don't think it was dodgy at all.
Anna, with one N, seemed unconvinced. People usually did.
But then, shouldn't the defence be that she had a good reason, not she happened to eat the food before she decided not to pay for it?
Maybe.
Oliver gave a little shrug.
But then we'd live in a world where the law says you're allowed to commit crimes if you think you've got a good reason. And who decides what a good reason is? It's like the it's only tea defence. If the law said that stealing only counted as stealing if you took something of significant monetary value, that would mean the law saw stealing a cup of tea from a poor person as a less serious crime than stealing a bottle of expensive wine from a rich person. And that doesn't seem very just.
He sighed.
I'm under no illusions about our legal system, I assure you. It has vast structural flaws, and miscarriages of justice absolutely do happen in both directions. But it's the best system we've got, and its problems generally aren't what people think they are.
And? I reached out and touched him on the shoulder, partly out of affection and partly out of a need for reassurance. We're okay, aren't we? We're not going to become like the cup of tea 7 or something. Oliver shook his head.
Fortunately for us, one of the vast structural flaws in our legal system is that being a group of white middle-class people on the way to an exclusive society wedding, of which I suspect at least one guest will be an actual High Court judge, the establishment is very much working in our favour.
Well, that was a relief. In a checking-your-privilege kind of way. Of course, they didn't have to charge us with anything to hold us for long enough to make us unfashionably late for Alex and Miffy's wedding, although given that it was going to be this massive posh bonanza full of aristos and arseholes, maybe that would be a blessing. For a while we sat quietly, contemplating our fate. Then Reese said,
"You know what I don't get?"
"What don't you get?"
asked Anna with one N, so that I didn't have to. The perplexed look on Reese's face would have been comical if it wasn't so sincere.
"I don't get why Charlie gave us directions to somebody else's house."
Chapter 22. They could hold us, Oliver said, for 24 hours, pretty much no questions asked. And I was beginning to think they were going to use all of it, when I heard a titanic commotion coming from elsewhere in the police station.
"Completely unacceptable," one voice was saying, not a voice I recognised.
"What do you expect in this part of the country?"
another voice was saying, and this one I thought I recognised but couldn't tell from where.
"Bloody Welsh and Irish everywhere."
"I say, steady on, Randy."
And that was a voice I recognised. That was Alex Twaddle.
"There's a Welsh chappy I work with, and he's fearfully pleasant."
Shit. The randomly insulting guy in the middle was Justice Mayhew. We'd had a run-in at Alex's club a couple of years ago, and he'd always struck me as exactly the kind of incompetent, bigoted bully you really hoped didn't wield vast judicial power. Still, I suppose if there was ever a time to meet a friendly, well, not friendly, but inclined to be on your side in this situation, judge, with a habit of browbeating people, it was when you were in a police station with pending charges of criminal trespass and grand theft Darjeeling. The three men made their way through to our little holding area, where Alex beamed an oblivious hello, while Justice Mayhew bore down at once on the officer on duty and began yelling.
"Well, hello, chaps and girl chaps," Alex said, while in the background an irate jurist well past retirement age spat a stream of invective at a hapless public servant. "Heard you had a spot of bother with the local constabulary. Beastly thing, but we'll soon have it sorted."
"Then if this country hasn't completely gone to the dogs,"
Justice Mayhew was saying,
"neither you nor anybody like you will work in law enforcement again."
"Incidentally," Alex continued, as if nothing loud and distracting was going on, "have you met my..."
"Never seen such a sorry excuse for a uniformed officer in all my born..."
"Daddy-in-law-to-be?"
He looked around, and when nobody said,
"Yes, we hang out all the time over foie gras and cribbage," went on.
"Everybody, this is Miffy's father, Douglas Lettuce, the Earl of Coombe Camden. Daddy-in-law-to-be, this is everybody."
We waved a series of uncertain highs and strained milords at the Earl, not quite sure how formal we were expected to be, given the circumstances.
"Right this minute, or God is my witness,"
continued Justice Mayhew behind us. He hadn't even paused for breath.
"Delighted to meet you all," said the Earl.
He was a short man, with beetling brows and hair that had long since shaded to grey. From his tone, I couldn't tell if he actually was delighted to meet us or not. He had that aristocratic way of speaking that made everything sound at once like he was discharging a grave duty and doing you a massive personal favour.
"Once this little unpleasantness..."
"No respect, that's the trouble, no respect at all,"
"is dealt with, might I suggest you accompany us back to Lettuce Manor, where we'll be more than happy to accommodate you."
I leaned back in my chair. Oh, thank fuck. Then I realised I'd just said fuck in front of an Earl,
and felt weird. Then I realised that I'd just had an incredibly I-know-my-place internalised classist reaction to saying a bad word in front of a man whose only distinction was that one of his distant ancestors had been mates with the king, and felt weirder.
Sorry, I was just thinking we might have to sleep in the bus.
I wouldn't hear of it.
The Earl shot a glance across the room to Justice Mayhew.
Are you done, Randy?
Almost. Giving this reprobate a piece of my mind.
The Earl of Coombe Camden nodded graciously.
If you could wrap it up a tad quicker, old boy.
I'll be speaking to your superiors,
Justice Mayhew finished. And that was it. Oliver had, as always, been right. Whatever the limitations of the British criminal justice system were, they definitely didn't include a tendency to be overly harsh on people who hung out with landed gentry. The bus, as it turned out, had been left at the crime scene. Well, the torch scene. Well, the scene of the incident that there's unlikely to ever be an official record of, because we were never formally charged, and an angry racist came and told everybody to let us go. But the police were very nice about it, and gave Rhys a lift to pick it up, and then we all got back in and followed the Earl to Lettice Manor. Alex insisted on riding with us, on the basis that it would be a wheeze, possibly because he'd never been on a bus before. But it... well, it wasn't. Not that we weren't all pleased and grateful to be out of custody after only a brief stay of several hours, but somehow ending a 4-hour drive with half a cup of tea and being arrested hadn't put many of us in a wheezing mood.
"By the way, Luke," said Alex, "got a joke for you."
"Really? Was this how my day was going to end?"
"You've got a joke for me."
"Thought it was about time. Turnabout is fair play and all that. And actually, I've done fearfully well out of all the corkers you've given me down the years. Told a couple to Miffy when we first met, and she absolutely adored them. Told one to the Earl when I asked his permission to marry the filly too."
"I wasn't going to ask which. I wasn't going to ask which."
"Which?"
"The one about the pieces of tarmac."
"I wasn't going to ask why. I wasn't going to ask why."
"Why that one?"
"Well, he likes cycling, so he liked that it was about a cycle path. Had to explain the play on words to him, mind, and he agreed with me that it didn't work terribly well, joke-wise, but that no harm had been done, and we shouldn't hold it against you."
"Oh," I said. "Thanks."
"Anyway,"
Alex clapped his hands and beamed.
"Here's my joke."
He cleared his throat.
"What does a Roman pirate say?"
"I don't know, Alex." I thought it only fair that I go through the full joke recipient routine. "What does a Roman pirate say?"
"Summus."
Everybody laughed except me, because I went to a state school. The annoying thing was, I could probably work out why it was supposed to be funny from context. I mean, it was a pirate joke. There's only two endings to a pirate joke, and one of them is just an attempt to subvert the original ending. Even more annoying was that I was about 60% sure that at least one other person in the bus was in the same boat I was, but had cruelly abandoned me to be the only one sitting here not laughing, like some kind of uneducated, humourless joke pleb. "Rhys," I asked, "why is that joke funny?" Still keeping his eyes firmly on the road, Rhys gave another one of those expressive shrugs that let me imagine his face with perfect clarity.
"I don't know, but everybody else was laughing, and I thought it'd be nice to join in. Besides, summus is a funny word. Sounds a bit sexual."
"It does not sound sexual," I protested. "You can't say, 'Baby, I want to summus you. I want to summus you all night long.'" Anna, with one end twisted around to look at me.
"You'd be surprised. I get all kinds of weird stuff in my DMs."
"You know," I told her, "I don't think I would be surprised." Alex was beginning to look crestfallen.
"You didn't tell me what you thought of my joke."
I wasn't sure what to say.
I think I'm not the target audience.
Really?
Alex looked perplexed.
It's very simple. You see, sumus is the first person plural of the verb to be.
Which means it's Latin for are, I replied. Yeah, I worked that much out for myself.
Then why didn't you laugh?
Why hadn't I? I suppose on a meta level I had got the joke. Fuck, why did every conversation with Alex end with me feeling like I was the one with the problem? I think to laugh, you need to understand it sort of instinctively.
Ah,
Alex nodded.
Makes sense. Moral of that story is to pay more attention to your Latin master.
I didn't have a Latin master. For a moment, Alex said nothing. Then he laughed more authentically than I'd ever heard him respond to any joke I'd ever told him.
Ah, because the chap was English, you mean? Good one!
No, I mean because I didn't learn... Tell you what, I've got a joke for you too. Alex sat upright.
Good-o, let's hear it.
What's a pirate's favourite cheese?
I don't know, replied Alex dutifully. What is a pirate's favourite cheese?
Jarlsberg. And there it was. Dead silence. Jarlsberg, I repeated.
Why do pirates like Jarlsberg?
Asked Alex, with near biblical innocence. I buried my head in my hands. Alex, you have just told me a joke in which the implicit association between pirates and the syllable R is the basis of the whole punchline.
Yes, but Jarlsberg doesn't begin with R. It begins with Jar.
Jar is a valid substitute, I insisted.
He's right, agreed Rhys. I often say Jar when I'm doing a pirate.
For a moment, Alex seemed to be processing. But then he nodded.
Ah. Well, in that case, I consider the joke excellent, and you may attribute my lack of laughter to my failure to understand it instinctively.
Anna, with one end, turned back around in her seat.
What type of cheese do you use to lure a bear out of a cave?
She asked. Barbara Clench poked her head around the seat in front.
I don't know, she said. What kind of cheese do you use to lure a bear out of a cave?
Come on, bear,
replied Anna with one N, doing a surprisingly effective impression of somebody waving a piece of camembert enticingly in front of a large predator. I laughed at that. I thought it deserved it. And so did everybody else. Well, everybody else except Alex.
Do bears eat cheese, then?
He asked.
I would have thought they preferred honey. Or maybe wildebeest?
Terribly sorry, said Alex, as he led us down a plush-carpeted corridor lined with portraits of rich, dead wankers.
It's just as Miffy and I need separate rooms. Can't see the bride before the wedding and all that. We've taken the two best suites already. And obviously there's a bunch of family up for the weekend, so we're going to have to stick you somewhere a bit substandard.
Until I met Oliver, being stuck somewhere a bit substandard was very much how I'd lived my life. Don't worry about it. And thanks for, the rescue and everything. Pushing open a door, Alex waved us through.
Oh, think nothing of it. Always happy to help out a chum. Besides, it gave me something to do. Fearfully excited about tomorrow and all that, but it does weigh on a chap.
The substandard room turned out to be significantly better than sleeping in a bus, and, for that matter, a fair sight better than sleeping in most houses I'd ever lived in. It was... Unlike Oliver, I didn't know what era it was. Somethingian, where the something was the name of a king and or queen, but that didn't exactly narrow it down. Edwardian? Elizabethan? Somewhere in the middle. Old and fancy is what I'm getting at. Big windows, four-poster bed, actual fireplace.
I suppose it must.
That was Oliver, keeping the conversation going while I was trying very hard not to faceplant on the nearest soft object.
Marriage is a significant step for anybody.
The problem with Oliver being a good person was that where I would have made a non-committal noise and waited for Alex to leave, he'd taken an interest. So now Alex was sitting in a chair with the air of somebody settling in for the evening. Or, in this case, early hours of the morning.
Yes, well, seemed the thing to do. After all, she's a smashing girl from a smashing family. Can't have Mummy and Daddy wondering if you're a homosexual your whole life.
He paused.
No offence.
On the one hand, some offence. On the other hand, it was the night before his wedding, and we'd dragged him out of bed to spring us from jail. So if there was ever a time to let it slide, this was it.
You realise, Oliver was looking terribly sincere, that even if you were, that would be okay.
Alex laughed.
Oh, of course it would. After all, it is the 20th century. One of my father's best friends is a homosexual, and they're all jolly supportive of him, especially his wife.
I said, isn't that a bit weird for her?
Can't see why it would be. Plenty of chaps have other interests. Daddy's simply batty about steam locomotives.
I really regretted not face-planting.
Okay, but assuming you mean exclusively homosexual rather than something under the bi umbrella,
I think that's quite different from doing a spot of train spotting.
Clearly you've never been married to a railway enthusiast.
No, I protested. But I'd like to be married to someone who is attracted to me. Frowning, Alex tried to take a sip from a glass of brandy that wasn't there.
That's a very short-sighted view of marriage. Surely if one's going to spend the rest of one's life with somebody, it's more important that they're, you know, the right sort of person.
What? I surreptitiously massaged a temple. Like belong to the right sort of clubs, and wear the right sort of hat at Ascot. Alex blinked.
Well, obviously.
And, Oliver put in gently, you feel Miffy is the right sort of person?
Of course I do, exclaimed Alex. Her father's an earl, for pity's sake, and her people have hardly any history of haemophilia.
Isn't that a bit eugenicsy? I asked. Alex smiled vaguely at me.
Thank you. We do try. Daddy picked Mummy because Granddaddy said we needed some height in the line.
Then I'm sure.
Oliver put a reassuring hand on Alex's shoulder.
You'll be very happy together, and everything will work out tomorrow.
The look in Alex's eyes, as he glanced up at Oliver, was not vulnerability exactly, because that had probably been bred out of him along with haemophilia and shortness, but a posh facsimile of it.
Cheers, he said. Decent of you.
Then, filled with a new resolve, he bounced to his feet.
Don't know what I'm fretting about, to be honest. After all, there's simply armies of people we've brought in to make everything go smoothly. We twaddles may not be able to fix photocopiers, but we've been getting married properly for centuries, and we're not about to start blowing it now.
He looked momentarily fretful.
Just, you know, being such a duffer. Very real chance I might duff something up.
You'll be fine, Oliver told him. Walk in a straight line, repeat whatever you're told to repeat, and say I do whenever someone asks you a question.
Unless...
I briefly stopped temple massaging. The question is... Do you love someone else? Alex ambled towards the door.
Well, I hope that won't come up. Seems a rather rum thing to ask a chap at his own wedding.
You're right, I sighed. I don't know what I was thinking.
Chapter 23. As soon as Alex had gone, I proceeded with my face planting.
I can't believe, I said, into the soft, enticing mattress. I have to be up for a wedding in 3.5 hours. Oliver sat down next to me.
Surely this cannot be the first time you've staggered home in the small hours of the morning, had a shower, and then left for work or a lecture or some major society function.
I was in my 20s then.
You're barely out of your 20s now.
I'm 30. I'm an old man. I can't cope with this wild, thrill-seeking, field-crossing, tea-stealing lifestyle anymore. Burying my head deeper into the bedclothes, I groaned like a zombie donkey. Also, I've got that thing where you get wet and you dry out, but you haven't really dried, and my pants are clinging to my bum in this weird way. He stroked my hair.
You're very sexy right now.
I am. I'm wearing sexy pants. That's why they're clinging.
Then I fear you've made a rod for your own buttocks.
No spanking, I whined. Too sleepy. There was a pause. Then Oliver said,
I appreciate I need a sleazy moustache in order to deliver this line properly, but we probably should get out of our wet clothes.
Trying to imagine Oliver in a sleazy moustache was sufficiently something that I brain-knotted myself back into wakefulness and began peeling my T-shirt off. Are you here to deliver a pizza? I asked. Is it 12 inches?
Yes.
It was Oliver's driest voice, which was pretty fucking dry.
I'm here with the 12-inch hot sausage pizza you ordered. Also, my penis.
My jeans had adhered to my legs in a way that might have looked enticing in a movie, but in real life was just clammy. I tried to wriggle attractively out of them and ended up thrashing around in a tangle of denim and sheets instead. I'm not sure porn is your calling.
Are you sure? I think the X-rated barrister has a certain ring to it. I was going to call my debut feature Habeas Porcus.
Not Men's Rear.
That'll be the sequel.
His eyes alighted on my, well, men's rear.
On the subject of which, those are some impressively tiny pants.
Thanks. I'd love to tell you I was planning something naughty for the wedding, but actually I just haven't done any laundry for a while.
I'll admit,
he said,
that was my first assumption.
Damn. That was the problem with the relationship lasting. You got to know each other too well.
Whether a product of necessity or design,
Oliver was still looking.
They remain very much appreciated.
He drew me into a hug. Mostly a hug. Sort of a grown-up hug. One of his hands sliding down to continue his appreciation of my underwear. Such as it was. He was mostly dressed, having shed only his jacket, which meant he was business casual and I was rent boy chic. So that was a mood. Not necessarily a bad mood, but a very specific one, and one I'd have been uncomfortable with had it been anyone but Oliver.
You are quite cold, he said, giving me a little rub.
Of the your arms and shoulders are chilly variety, not of the fun variety. Trust Oliver to care more about my well-being than my arse. I shrugged. I'll be okay. I mean, you can always warm me up. Unfortunately, Oliver was still fixated on making sure I didn't die of a chill like a Victorian spinster.
Shall I run you a bath?
The thing was, I didn't need Oliver to run me a bath. I was perfectly capable of running one for myself. But it was nice, wasn't it? To be taken care of? I guess that'd be lovely. He drew the quilt from the bed and wrapped it round me, which shifted the vibe from sexy boy slut to starving urchin rescued by kindly gentlemen, before disappearing into the ensuite. From within came the sound of Oliver's shoes moving efficiently on tiles, along with the heavy gurgling of early 20th century pipework. Eventually I drifted through,
where I was largely unsurprised to discover that even the substandard rooms in Lettice Manor came equipped with the kind of bath that Roman senators would fuck their boyfriends in.
"Wow," I said, peering through the steam at Oliver. "You must really love me."
Oliver peered back, his normally austere hair gone curly in the heat. "Well, I do. But have I done something to make it particularly obvious?"
"Just that you've run this whole bath for me," I told him, "and you haven't once mentioned what a horrible waste of water it is."
"Well, it is a horrible waste of water. But in the overall scheme of things, I think you can permit yourself one bath. Besides..."
He gave me a smile that said mean Oliver hadn't quite left the building.
"I think you're probably owed a few."
"Are you saying I don't wash?" I protested.
"I'm saying that between your unwillingness to do dishes and your occasional failure to be arsed with a shower, you've probably shrunk your water footprint enough to be indulgent just this once."
I dequilted and depantsed and descended down the marble steps into the steamy, bubbly, lightly scented water. "I wash, both myself and dishes." I paused. "Not simultaneously, although, thinking about it, that would really cut my water footprint."
"You're right," Oliver conceded. "I've maligned you unjustly. I suppose I'm still traumatized by that time you left a plate in the living room for a week."
"So did you."
"It was your plate."
He folded his arms.
"And I was waiting to see if you'd notice."
"It wasn't a messy plate. It had only had a sandwich on it."
"Even so, plates belong in the kitchen, in the cupboards, not in the living room."
I stretched out in the water, floating slightly, which frankly felt weird. Most baths I couldn't even straighten my legs in. "Is this what being married to you is going to be like?"
"It's what I'm like."
There was an unexpectedly defensive note in his voice.
"So it may well be."
Mostly I'd been teasing, and I'd thought he was to begin with. But somewhere down the line we'd snagged on the brambles of an old argument. "I'm sorry about the plate," I said. "I'd genuinely kind of stopped seeing it. But I haven't done it again, and, you know, you can always say, 'Luke, pick up your shit.' Or rather..." I did my best, Oliver, which was nowhere near as good as the real thing.
"Lucian, please rationalise your paraphernalia."
His lips twitched.
"I do not sound like that."
"You sound a bit like that. Also, I'm still upset you said I never shower."
"I didn't say you never showered. I just pointed out that sometimes you skip a day."
"Everybody skips a day," I insisted. "It's healthy, for natural oils and things. And it's not like I smell." "Oh my God, do I smell? You'd tell me if I smelled, right? Except you didn't tell me about that plate." He undid the top button of his shirt.
"Yes, I'd tell you if you smelled, which you don't. I was trying to make a light-hearted reference to the fact that you're sometimes adorably..."
That wasn't a good pause.
"Uninterested in routine."
"Who's interested in routine? It's routine. The clue is in the name." I splashed water in his direction, which made him dance his shoes out of the way. "Also, are you just going to stand there criticising my personal habits while I have a bath?" That made him pinken slightly.
"Of course not. I'll leave you to it."
"I more sort of meant you could join me, if you want to." He hesitated, with that anxious, half-hopeful look in his eyes he sometimes got around dessert. "This thing is huge," I added. "How many huge bath opportunities are we going to get in our lives?"
"Probably several, if we wanted them."
"Come on, Oliver. I'm lonely and, you know, wet."
"Lucian, I...
It'll save water, I interrupted. Ethics demand that you get in the bath with me.
It's just... He hesitated again. On the subject of routines, I haven't been to the gym recently, and, well, the lighting in here is quite harsh.
Ah. Between this and the plate, I wasn't winning any sensitivity awards this year. The thing was, Oliver had been in therapy for about 18 months now, and while it had really helped him in some ways, it was a steps-forward, steps-back situation. Like, he'd got to the point where he was no longer obsessively going to the gym every day and treating food like the enemy, but worrying less about his body 90% of the time had made him more self-conscious the other 10%. I mean, he was still far and away the fittest person I'd ever seen in real life. But the problem with giving yourself an eating disorder in pursuit of an impossible beauty standard was that if you got rid of one, you got rid of the other. Oliver, I said, you don't have to do anything you're not comfortable with. But you're the most amazing, gorgeous, sexy man I have ever been allowed to do depraved things to. And I don't think that's ever going to change. Even when we're married, and we both stop trying, and you're, like, 75 with nose hair. He looked faintly appalled.
I will never have nose hair.
Well, I'd be into you even if you did. Now come on. I tried to signal this is a safe, if aquatic, space. Get in the bath.
Slipping off his shoes and socks, he padded over and crouched down at the top of the steps. I do know you're not judging me. I just find it very hard not to judge myself.
I tried to be sensitive to Oliver's body image issues. I really did. But at the end of the day, he looked like him, and I looked like me. And sometimes it was hard to remember that when he was being down on himself, he wasn't being down on me by association. Still, and this was definitely something I couldn't have done even a year ago, sometimes when you wanted someone to trust you, you had to trust them first. So I stood, letting the water stream off me like a shit Venus, waded over and kissed him, a hand catching the collar of his shirt and my lips hard and urgent on his. Trying to say things that I didn't know how to say, asking him to believe that I loved him and I wanted him and that he'd never be anything but beautiful to me. When I finally let him go, he was tousled and blushing and...
Lucien, now I'm drenched.
Then, I said, you might as well be in the bath. I gave him what I intended to be a playful tug on the arm, but I hadn't quite factored in things like gravity and balance and wet marble. Oliver had just enough time for a flail and a...
What the...
before we tumbled backwards into the bath with an enormous splash. Thankfully, it was deep enough and wide enough that we didn't die. Oliver resurfaced in a flurry of wet fabric and bubbles. Thankfully, he was laughing rather than glowering, complaining, or pointing out quite how close he'd come to cracking his head open.
That was very... very you, Lucien.
It was an accident.
Exactly.
I took a moment to appreciate Oliver in a near-transparent white shirt clinging to all the bits of his body that I, coincidentally, liked clinging to. For the record, this... I made a kind of rectangle that was meant to encompass all of him. Is really working for me.
Thank you.
He looked flustered.
It's actually quite uncomfortable.
There's a solution to that.
He still looked flustered. Kiss me again first.
In my head, I mermaided into his arms, full of seduction and mystery. But I was very much a land-based organism, so I sort of half-stumbled, half-waded forward, nearly knocking him over again, and finally managed to smack my lips onto his.
Thankfully, we'd had some practice at this. The kissing, not the navigating a neoclassical bath in an Earl's country house. And after a teeny bit of fumbling and nose orientating, we settled into one of the few routines I saw the point of. The world melting away beneath the familiarity of Oliver's mouth against mine. His taste, and the heat of him, and the way he always kissed me so carefully at first, like he wanted me to know I was precious, before he lost himself in urgency. And we got rough and messy and desperate for each other. Even after 2 years, when surely it should have stopped feeling this way, all, you know, intense and stuff. Honestly, it still kind of scared me sometimes. And not just because the last time I'd let myself get this close to someone, I'd been really badly hurt, but because I'd never let myself get this close to someone, I wasn't sure I'd ever known how. Until I'd met Oliver, and falling in love with him had left me defenseless. I took the opportunity to make a mid-kiss play for his trousers, and again, in my head, this had been seamless and sexy. Except in practice, a wet belt was a pisser to undo, and wet buttons did not slide easily through eye holes. I did, eventually, manage to wrangle him out, but I nearly drowned and lost anything that might have resembled dignity. "Are you all right?" Oliver asked, laughed, as I spluttered back to the surface. I spat out half the bath. "Fine. Lungs are overrated." He was still laughing as he kissed me again, and for a while we made out like Love Island contestants, only without the cameras and the sarcastic Scottish voiceover. The water buoyed us up in this slightly magical way, and I was light as champagne bubbles, drifting with Oliver through the foam. Lying back against the wall of the bath, I let him float in my arms for a while. "I can't believe this is going to be us in a few months," I told him.
"Isn't it us right now?" he asked.
"No, I mean, getting married. Not in a cathedral, of course, and not putting all our guests up in a palace the night before, but..."
"Yeah."
He was quiet. Too quiet.
"It does seem rather unreal, doesn't it?"
Even this late at night, even naked and covered in soap, I could tell when he was tense.
"Are you okay?" "Yes. It's just..."
For a while he stopped there, leaving me to speculate about all the various justs it could be.
"I think, in an ideal world, my parents wouldn't be making such a fuss."
I shrugged. "Fuck 'em."
"That's all very well for you to say."
He half swiveled to look at me.
"And I know you're right, on some level. But it doesn't really make things any easier."
Yeah, that was the problem. And chances are, it would always be the problem. "It'll be okay," I tried. "We're having lunch with them next week, and I promise I'll do my best to get back in their good graces."
"Thank you, but their good graces are not that easy to access."
And that was the problem too. Actually, it was the same problem. "I know, but I'll try, although if it doesn't work, I do reserve the right to go back to the fuck 'em strategy."
"That seems a reasonable compromise."
He relaxed back against me, and for a while it seemed like we could stay forever in that warm, magical space, where all our troubles seemed as insubstantial as foam. Eventually, though, the water cooled, and my toes got unattractively wrinkly. And so we climbed up the now even slipperier marble steps in search of towels. In some ways, I was sorry to see Oliver shed his still-on, still-transparent, still-clingy shirt, but his body underneath, for all his insecurities, more than made up for it. I stroked lightly over his chest, making him shiver, before wrapping him up.
Normally, Oliver was a vigorous and efficient dryer, rubbing himself down like he was sanding a bench. But tonight, or I suppose technically this morning, the time, or the bath, or the kissing, had clearly got to him, because he seemed happy to snuggle dry, as per my preferred practice. Entoweled, we headed back to the bedroom, where what sounded worryingly like the dawn chorus was beginning to filter through the windows.
"What time is it?" asked Oliver, blinking.
I scooped my phone from the table and had a look.
"You don't want to know."
"Is it try to sleep o'clock, or pull an all-nighter o'clock?"
"It's 1:45, could go either way."
"Ah."
He pushed his damp hair back from his forehead.
"I'll admit the all-nighter has never been my go-to strategy."
I wouldn't say it had been a strategy for me so much as how things tended to work out. The trick is to push through the 1 hour when you really, really want to go to bed.
"Just out of curiosity."
A wave of fatigue washed over Oliver's face.
"Is that hour now?"
It wasn't right now for me, but I suspected it could come on any minute. "Kind of. We need to find a way to distract each other." He laughed.
"I could run another bath."
"But think of your water footprint."
"Is your way to distract yourself teasing me?"
"It's working," I grinned. The other issue with the hour of all-nighter criticality was that it always passed incredibly slowly. I glanced around the room, looking for anything to occupy us. And it couldn't be the bed, because that was a one-way ticket to sleeping through Alex's wedding. Unfortunately, while our surroundings were sumptuous in many ways, they were surprisingly short on entertainment. I suppose when you could ring a bell and get a servant to bring you a live peacock and a handjob whenever you felt like it, there wasn't much need to also keep a snakes and ladders set handy. Finally, my gaze settled on the fireplace, which was still crackling merrily and casting orange shadows over what I suspected was a very expensive Persian rug. "Oliver," I said. He gave a little jolt.
"Yes, I'm awake. I'm definitely awake."
"Oliver," I said again. His eyes narrowed warily.
"That's your I've got an inappropriate idea face."
I did. I totally did. You see that offensively posh rug by that offensively pretty fireplace? That's an actual fireplace with, like, fire in it.
"I do a great many things for you, Lucien, but I draw the line at arson."
Because Oliver kept relentlessly to a very sensible bedtime, I'd never seen him quite this dazed before. It was honestly kind of adorable. I stared at him. "Oh my God, how did you get to arson from we should do something to keep ourselves awake?" The slightest pause.
"Be gay, do crimes?"
I was thinking more, be gay, have sex, you know, on the rug, in front of the fireplace. Because it's here, and I think we'll regret it if we didn't. Another pause.
"You want me," he asked slowly, "to make love to you in front of the fireplace?"
"Yes." It came out a little more aggressive than I intended it. "Tenderly, in soft focus, with violins."
"Well, I am quite tired, so I suppose that counts as soft focus. And while I'm sure there's a string quartet somewhere in the building, I don't think that would fall within their job description."
"Fine." I cast off my towel and arranged myself as seductively as I could on the rug. "Just, you know, romance me, baby. Romance me hard." And Oliver, looking, I thought, significantly more awake than he had 3 minutes ago, crossed the room after me. He dropped to his knees and settled his body over mine, and I reached up my arms to embrace him. As it turned out, the whole fireplace thing hadn't been totally oversold. The light painted us in tiger stripes of gold and shadows, and the heat fell over us gently, like all the good bits of a blanket. I can't lie. I felt sexy as hell.
"Oh, Lucien," Oliver murmured.
And I gazed up at him, too tired and too happy to resent my own sincerity.
"I love you."
So, yeah, that was a thing that happened. Oliver, and a fireplace, and a soft rug. It was probably the least me thing I'd ever done. And I was okay with that.